Hilda. We'll talk about their shared love of country music and photography, plus songs and stories about dear old mama from Bo Diddley, Sonny Rollins, and Billie Holiday, among others. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Coming up Friday afternoon at 1 on KRVS.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, a public service of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Find us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to The Exchange. This is Cheryl Castile. My guest today in the studio, a very, very talented filmmaker, among other things that she does in life. But Connie Castile is the Assistant Director for Moving Image Arts here at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. It's under the Cinema Studies program. She also teaches some classes in film and English. And what Connie has really gotten to be known for in this area is her filmmaking. And her films focus on what are, for a lot of people, everyday things that occur in their life, whether it's employment, whether it's just things that we do. But for other people who may not live in this area, even though they're everyday things here, they're very unique to people outside of here, and even to some folks that live here in the state. She has the films I Always Do My Color First, King Crawfish, and Raised on Rice and Gravy, that we're going to talk about those three before we talk about her new one that she has just released. But those first three films were all shown at the Cannes Film Festival, which is a pretty big deal in itself. The I Always Do My Colors First won a special jury prize at the 2007 Port Townsend Film Festival. It also won the Directors win in the Louisiana Filmmaker of the Year at the New Orleans Film Festival, and Raised on Rice and Gravy won Best Short Film at the New Orleans Film Festival, and King Crawfish was nominated for Best Short Film. Right? Best short film?
Not short, feature.
Oh, for feature film.
Yeah.
That's right. That was a longer one, for feature film.
Yeah, that was a little
longer. So welcome, Connie.
Thank you.
We could go on and on, but we'll get you talking for a little bit.
Well, good.
I mean, that's a pretty big deal. I would think, you know, I was thinking about some things with you last night, and, when you search for somebody, too, I thought last night, that must be like a really big thrill. When your name comes on...
To Google yourself?
Yeah, and different, different filmmaker websites that you show up on. And then just the fact that in library-type sites of films, there's films by filmmaker Connie Castile.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Cool.
I mean, especially when you think... it took me a while to get used to even the idea of being called a filmmaker, because it wasn't as though, you know, since I was six, I wanted to be a filmmaker. At all. It was just because of my folklore studies that it occurred to me that a lot of these stories that I was collecting really lent themselves to visual expression, you know, via film.
So that's where that all... So it wasn't you as this kid going to the theater each night?
No.
It's
not that romantic.
No, but that's interesting. Yeah, but no, this is interesting.
Yeah. And so I guess I come to it from a storytelling perspective.
Yeah.
Like an oral history perspective.
Because your background also is in English.
In English and folklore.
Yeah.
And philosophy.
And so when you thought, but when you thought about, which is interesting because the philosophy part is what really makes you think.
It does
about
make
what's
you
going
think.
On through people's brains and why are they doing the things they do.
Or human behavior for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what is that all about and how they do it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, no, that's all. I guess... I'm sure that all of this is a accumulation of all of my experiences, both just education and life and living and all. So, yeah, it all just kind of comes out through this, I suppose.
Now, I always do my college first. Prior to that, had you done some just kind of short?
No.
Even like was nothing. That was
nothing.
Your first dive,
yes,
into making,
yes,
a film.
I had switched from the behavioral sciences here at UL, where I was working with children and doing comparative behavioral biology. With children and chimpanzees, actually.
Ah.
And I wanted to go to grad school, so I decided to do folklore here at UL and kind of chipped away at that while I was working full-time. And that's when I got introduced, I guess, to feeling compelled to... got introduced to folklore and feeling compelled to actually kind of do a documentary. But it started out with a class I was taking with Marcia Godet. I had taken a lot of folklore classes with John Loden as well. And it was Marcia's class, well, and John's as well, where I looked at ironing. And I wrote a research paper on ironing. We had read a journal article. It was entitled "Why Folklorists Should Study Housework," and it talked about about washing dishes, cleaning,
yeah,
a house, the different degrees you clean it. It's traditional; you learn it from typically mother, grandmother, and anyway, they mentioned ironing a little bit, and of course, my mother is in the film. She's one, yeah, of the fanatic ones in there, and so I just went to her and started doing some field work, casually talking about ironing, and it became clear really fast that she knew all of the women in her community that ironed,
yeah,
the best ironers, what kind of iron they had, whether they starched or not, what kind of starch. I mean, it was, so there was a conversation going,
yeah,
on. So then, you know, gradually interviewed a bunch of women, maybe 12 women altogether in the community. And then from that, narrowed it down to 4 that actually end up in the film.
And now, when did you meet Allison Bull? Because we're going to mention,
okay,
Allison Bull has worked with you on all of these films.
That's
as
right.
Your cinematographer.
That's right. Allison, I was Diana Stetko is an English professor here, and she does these incredible experimental theater productions.
Which is how we did leave out that Connie also,
oh, yeah,
acts.
Well.
And she acts probably
experimental
once,
theater.
Once, like once a year in Diana's.
Yeah, once a year. Okay. One night, once a year.
Yeah.
There was a video component to this particular one, and Allison was there filming, and she was the only one I knew with a camera, and I certainly didn't know how to do that and wasn't very interested in learning that part of it. So I just asked her if she would be interested in making a film about, I forgot, I was using some big words to be impressive, the domesticity of ironing or something. And she just looked at me and said, yep. So that's how that happened. And it was kind of interesting because we had the process that we go through, that I go through for the films, is before the camera comes out, I do a lot of pre-production. So I go out, like I was saying, just a plain little recorder, get the stories, go back, transcribe, write a script, then and go with a camera, you know, in a little crew if I have to. But
So you kind of go out and do the scouting first.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, besides gathering the stories, you're scouting to see what you want.
And a lot,
yeah,
of research.
Okay.
So a lot of research, a lot of field work. And so once I had the script together, I wanted to introduce Allison to the women before we show up with the camera. And we go to Aunt B's house. I guess you saw the film.
Yeah.
And we go to Tom B's house, and she falls in love with Allison. She's trying to marry Allison off to her grandson. And we get in the car to leave, and Allison looks at me. She says, Connie, it was hard for me to understand what she was saying. And first thing I thought of, there's no way I'm going to put subtitles on Aunt B, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But Allison is from Shreveport, Bossier area. Well, Bossier. And it was interesting because I think it's kind of good to have that inside-outside, mm-hmm, you know, perspective. Sometimes I might miss something because I am from here.
Sure.
And then here she is coming in, and things seem new or weird or, you know, different,
yeah,
for her. So it was just a matter of her getting used to the accent.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And then I've had people that grew up here, live away, and they get the film, they put it on. One woman told me, she said, I put it on Saturday mornings. I've seen it 100 times, but I just want to hear the accents and hear the music while I'm cleaning my house.
Mm.
So it's kind of neat.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it spurred conversations. I mean, I just know for me personally, my husband and I both iron differently.
Yeah.
Opposite sides of the boards, all this. And then it was going to my mother and saying, where did you learn to iron? Mm-hmm. Is this how you iron? Am I ironing the way you iron? You know, because we got in this big discussion of what was right and what was wrong.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Know? And then why you do it.
Exactly.
Too. You know, and I think in the film, it's about that nurturing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you care about how your family looks when they step out of the house. And
sure.
For these women, it's a reflection on them. And then the artful, the way it's kind of an artistic expression for them.
Yeah.
You know, this before and after that they've created something. So.
And, you know, it's interesting with that film. I'm going to jump for a minute to the new film you have out, Tigolo, A Louisiana Horse Story. Because now that takes a look at the whole kind of horse way of life around here, people that are involved with horses in the horse industry, from things that people do as a business to what people do in their leisure time, you mm-hmm. know, regarding horses. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting with the irony, because the one thing I always think about with some of the dances or with some of the Creole trail rides that you have, that you focus on in the film, I always think about so many people's jeans at those dances afterwards being so nicely pressed.
Oh, yeah.
And ironed.
Just
you
look
know?
At Gino's shirt.
Exactly. And you look at Gino Delafosse.
I don't know
you
how he plays
that
accordion.
Yeah,
but,
yeah. Yeah. That there's, I mean, what you talk about too with that pride in how one looks,
mm-hmm.
I always think of that with the jeans,
mm-hmm.
you know?
I think the cowboys in general are seem to be always starched and, you know, lines, creases down the sleeves, creases down the jeans.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's, I want to move into this film because there's a lot to talk about your
All
new
right.
film. But Tigolo, A Louisiana Horse Story, can we talk about where your idea came about for doing this particular project?
I think it's just, well, a couple of things. One, just living here, I think you just start to notice there's a lot of horseback traditions ranging from the Creole trail rides, the country Mardi Gras that's done on horseback, the tournoi, which is that jousting competition,
yeah.
The jockeys. We have a high number of jockeys that come out of this area all within like a 20-30 mile radius that make it big into the Kentucky
yeah.
Derby, Preakness, and Belmont. And then also at about the same time, you were hearing trail rides come under a lot of scrutiny for some of them were growing very big and was putting pressure on, you know, municipalities.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I don't know about you, but almost on any given Sunday, like for me in Bro Bridge, you would see some Creole cowboys riding through town, you know, just a few, a handful of them. And it was really nice to see.
Yeah.
And it just made me start to wonder, like, why do we have all of this? And then once I started researching it, it seems to all be connected to this cattle history that we had, you know, over 250 years ago, that you needed horses to when you had cattle. And then given, I think, the joie that Creoles and Cajuns have, it was just a matter of time before we started having fun with these animals,
yeah.
like racing them or just playing with them.
You know, and I think in a film like this, you really cover so much in it. Although when you're watching the film, it's not a film where it felt like there was so much all of a sudden had to be
so
pressed into a certain amount of
yeah.
time. Because
yeah.
it flowed so nicely.
Thank you.
Which is a, you know, which is a credit to you. But, you know, from where you start at the very beginning, you know, and one of the things you talk about in the beginning is those, how when people had, you know, their large, and I don't know if herds is the correct term, of horses. I don't know what you call
it. Of horses?
Yeah, but then when they had to, you know, when they did the branding with the cattle and everything.
Yeah.
But when
yeah.
you talk about all the, you know, and they're herding the cattle.
Right,
but you
right,
talk
right.
about the brands.
Right.
And, you know, there's, I have to look up, because when I had a shop years ago, I had a book on those brands,
on
the Louisiana brands that a gentleman, and I have to try to figure out where that came from and who that was and if it's the same book you had.
Yeah, well, this book is actually in the Louisiana room here at UL. You can't check it out, of course.
Yeah,
it's a
but
massive
you go, I have
book.
To go.
But there have been publications that they'll have like a copy of the brands in
yeah.
the book. So it might have been something like that where it's not the original brand book, of
sure.
course. But here at the library in the Louisiana room, we have the brand book from, I think it's 1730 and 1765. And it's through the branding books and court records and all, like secessions, that we know who basically owned cattle back then. And when you look in the book, it's free people of color, sauvages, meaning the Indians, and women. Women were allowed. As Ray Bressa refers to it, it was like the equal opportunity business, because you didn't have to have land because of the laws at the time, which were the olage, meaning cattle could roam freely. You didn't have to fence them in. So all you needed was that brand, and everybody's cattle intermingled for grazing. And once you were ready to either take some cattle out or brand the calves, then you would rope them and bring them in and herd them together. Thus the need of a horse.
Sure.
That's why the brand was so important, because of the olage laws. And another thing that contributed to, I think, the success of the cattle industry here was our prairie grass.
Yeah.
You didn't have to buy feed. They could roam freely and have plenty of food.
We're going to talk a little bit later, too, about where folks can go see this film. But where did you get the footage that you have of the herds and the crossing of the waterways going into the intercoastal? Where did those come from?
Isn't that amazing?
It's fascinating.
It is fascinating. Bubby Henderson from Vinton, his dad basically ran the Gray Ranch out in Ged for probably 40-something years. In Ged, Louisiana, outside of Vinton.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, huge ranch. And in 1952, the family decided they were no longer going to kind of be in that big of cattle industry, and so they sold off the herd. So they knew that this was going to be the last drive of moving the cattle from the summer grazing to the winter grazing and all, and back and forth. So somebody had the sense to film it. So it's amazing footage, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was curious about, you know, because things like that you see, like I've only seen it like maybe recreated in a film, but the first thing I thought of when I was watching and saw that, it's such a massive quantity of livestock and horses that it was almost this panicky feeling about, oh my gosh, what about the one way over there on the right? Are you gonna get me? I mean, because there's so many of them, and you know, it's so interesting how, you know, animals have that whole instinctual quality to them, too, that, you know, a lot of them know what's going on.
Yeah, but I think that's one of the unique things about a Louisiana marsh cowboy, is that these cattle do have to swim and cross waterways and marshes and all that. And that's part of the thing, again, geography making our cowboys pretty unique in that sense, and cattle kind of unique from the prairie grass to the marsh and all. So,
and they had filmed that back then just for their own family.
Footage, absolutely. Now they still, I'm told, I'm pretty sure it is, we just didn't get to go film it. It still goes on today, not in the quantity, you know, in the size, but they are still, cowboys are still moving cattle across water and in the marshes.
You would think, yes, but because there's so much water around.
I mean, you can't
down
help
in
it.
That area,
and
you'd
more
have
coming
to.
In every day.
So. Yeah, do you know? Cecil, I wonder if we could cue up. We're going to play the trailer. From this film, just to kind of give people an audio feel of what this film is all about. Do you want to talk a little bit about the trailer before we play it?
Well, you're going to hear different voices, and I think one of the things in the film, too, that we paid a lot of attention to was the soundtrack, music, and sound effects, because, again, we had this old footage that obviously didn't have any audio, so we played around a lot with Foley sounds, and it's a beautiful film to listen to, too, I think.
Yeah. All right, this is the official trailer from Tigolo, A Louisiana Horse Story.
Louisiana has good cowboys. They grew up riding horseback and helping their daddies.
We were the cowboys. My parents and the grandfather, they were the original cowboys.
When I first started, I was about 7, 8 years old in the bush track.
There's so many things that we do even today that we've just been doing because the people before us did it.
So my little boys, they're 7 and 6 right now. They each have their own little horse that they ride, and trying to teach them how to respect animals, and it helps you to become a better person in life.
The best thing for the inside of a man is the outside of a horse. When you turn about and let him run loose and run free, It's just a beautiful thing.
It was crazy. It was plum crazy. Never a moment without a whole bunch of crazy excitement.
It's a shame that the Bush Tracks are no more. Didn't just bring jockeys. It brought a mentality.
But them days are gone. We'll never see that again.
I guess it's time for the old people to move on.
Okay, if you're just joining us, this is The Exchange, and my guest today is filmmaker Connie Castile, and we're talking about a number of the films she's done, but really what we're focusing on is her latest release, Tigolo, A Louisiana Horse Story, and what you just heard was the trailer for that, which you can watch again to get yourself interested before you go to the film. You can see it. It is on YouTube if you search for that on the internet. You know, you talked about the sound of this film. There are so many different, if you look at all the different things with sound, there's so many different voices. There are so many different natural sounds. You know, when you think of the sound of the horses and whether, what kind of ground they're on or being in water. And the other thing is what you have, you know, the sound of where they're racing, the sound of, you know, there's so many sounds. And then you tie the music in. And now the music, Christy Guillory worked on that with
you. Yes, Christy Guillory is the music supervisor. She also was the music supervisor on King Crawfish. So so she's the music supervisor, and then I wrote down the people that are in it. I'd love to mention them. We had, there were a couple of leftovers, I call them, from the Black Pot Festival. So Rick Good and Sharon Leahy, I think is how you say it. And then they were like special guests, as well as Eric Fry, who's from around here, and Rose Sinclair. And then Glenn Fields, Chaz Justice, and Chris Stafford. And it was all recorded in Chris Stafford's studio in Lafayette. So this is about as local a film as you can get, from crew to content. So
And was Christy, in terms of her kind of heading it out, or any of those folks, were they given the film in pieces? Or was it, oh, they were,
unfortunately, in like little bits of pieces. We were running behind on schedule. This was funded, and I want to make sure I say that too, by the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities and the Louisiana Entertainment and the Division of the Arts through their Decentralized Arts Fund that's administered through the Acadiana Center for the Arts. So when you, you know, that's typically how documentaries get done, is through grants. And when you have that, you have deadlines, because
You
need to
meet that.
So we were working hard to meet those deadlines, and fortunately, we would send basically daily, bring them a new edit, and they would watch it and score and watch it and score. So I'm sure it wasn't the most ideal situation for them, but they did an incredible job.
Oh, yeah. And I have to ask, and I'm going to jump way to the end of the film, because I'm going to tell you, the end of this film really, besides many other things, makes you want to start it over again. Watch it again.
Good.
You know, it goes all of a sudden into this, I mean, the filming there, it's focused on some flowers in the fields, and then this beautiful song. And I'm curious about the song where there's all the voices that come in together.
What is that?
Is that an original song? Is that those guys?
It's those guys.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I know. Isn't it incredible? And the field is actually, our prairie grass is almost extinct. It's definitely endangered, and there's these restoration projects going on. And this is a field, it's called the Dural Field outside of Eunice. And I forgot how many acres it is, where they're bringing back the wildflowers, the prairie grass. And so we basically, with the help of Cecil Brown, who's also in the film from Eunice, he brought, I guess, 5 or 6 horses out there.
And to the Dural site?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We got permission from them to do that. And we really wanted to capture the horses wild and free to have that image and kind of simulate what it would have been like, you know, 200 years ago.
Sure.
So that's how the film opens. basically.
Yeah.
With that footage. But,
you know, I want to mention, too, that what you mentioned about the Durald site, the Prairie Preservation Group out of Eunice and Durald, they also have one of those sites in Eunice that they have worked really hard
at. Downtown Eunice, practically.
Yeah, right when you come, yep, yeah.
There's two sites.
And they've got great walking paths, and then they've also done it where I'm at, where I work at, out at the St. Linda Parish Visitor Information Center.
Oh, good.
They have recreated, they've done demo plots out there, and, I mean, it's amazing with all volunteers.
Yeah. Well, when the film opens, I don't know if you remember this, we have a reading from a quote from a journal of William Darby.
Yeah.
Yeah, William Darby was a geographer that was sent here right after the Louisiana Purchase. Basically, Jefferson wanted to know, okay, what the heck did we just buy?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So he sent this geographer out to survey all the land of the purchase, and he, in his journal, he comes across these prairies in South Louisiana, and he's just blown away by it, by its beauty, the thousands of heads of cattle that are out there. And when the Acadians got here, they were very encouraged by the government to go into the cattle because they needed to feed New Orleans, basically.
Sure.
So eight Acadian families were given a bull and some cattle and sent out to the prairies to start cattle. But again, when you see the film, before they get here, we already had Creoles already kind of ranching, starting that process through trading posts.
Yeah. You know, I enjoyed you featured Gino Delafosse in there, who, you know, most people know as a musician, but also a big horseman.
Mm-hmm.
The comment he made about, you know, sometimes when people look at him, first of all, he's this black young man. Mm-hmm. Well, he's not as young. Sorry, Gino, you're not as young as you
used to
be. He's still young. A lot younger than I am. But
that was Cheryl that said that, not Connie.
Then he's got a cowboy hat on, is what he says.
Mm-hmm.
And then I start playing an accordion.
Yeah.
And then he's singing in French.
And then he opens his mouth and he's singing in French.
Exactly. And that was such a, which is pretty unique.
Yeah.
To a lot of people out there.
Right. I mean, you know, growing up and all these spaghetti westerns and all that, you never saw black cowboys.
Yeah.
I mean, they just, and yet the black cowboy was the first cowboy in this area.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. What are some of the things that surprised you when making this film, whether it was about the subject matter, whether it was about your process as a filmmaker? What are some things that just really surprised you during this process?
Oh, there's a lot, I guess. Well, from the content, doing all the research and discovering all this, how all these things were converging to make the cattle industry so viable here. The au large, like I was telling you about, the prairie grass. It just seemed that I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I just didn't know that, and I thought that was pretty fascinating. Then once you start to talk with people, and I guess that at the Cajun jockeys, for one thing, I knew we had all these Cajun jockeys, and I just assumed we would always have these great Cajun jockeys because we've got horsemen out here, black and white. And but what I learned is that no, because the reason we have these Cajun jockeys so successful is that we had these bush tracks, these, you know, rural dirt tracks all over the place around here. And when they were 5, 6, 7 years old, they were racing.
That's what they were doing.
These were unsanctioned tracks. And by the time they were 16 and old enough to get a license, a jockey's license, at these recognized tracks like the Fairgrounds or Evangeline Downs, they were seasoned riders. I mean, they had an advantage over everyone else. And
I think, you know, you talked to the interview you have with Calvin Burrell in the film. He talks about that was such an important part of his growing up, was being able to start out on those bush tracks.
All those jockeys, Shane Sellers, Mark Gidgey, Robbie Alborado, I mean, they all just, it made them not only good riders, but horsemen, because they did everything. They cleaned stalls, they cared for the animals. And even today, and Calvin says this in, I don't think it's in the film, but it was in my the radio show that I had done, but he says, you know, every day he wakes up, 4:30, he's riding his horse. He needs to know that horse, and he'll go back to the trainer, and if he notices something about the horse, he says, I think, you know, without stepping on the trainer's toes, he said, I think we need to work on that. I think something's bothering it, you know, whatever. But they they're like little horse whisperers.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, you talk with any of folks who do work with animals. I mean, you have to have that connection.
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
to be good.
Right. And that respect for the animal.
Exactly.
You know, the Creole cowboys and the Cajun cowboys, a lot of respect for these animals. And just kind of on an equal hoof, if you will.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like,
that's a good way to phrase it.
They just, they really care for these animals. And it shows. I mean, the horses are beautiful.
Yeah. There was one thing I'm trying to, I think it was in one of the bush track races. They were showing, with one young kid on one horse, and then they talked about if they wanted to have a horse in, but I don't know if there wasn't somebody to ride it, but so they put a beer can, they tied an empty beer can.
Hold on, I'm
choking. Yeah, we're
going to
choke. You know what? While we're taking a drink of water, let's take a break, and we're going to listen to the Balfa Brothers. We're going to listen to a song that they did that is really fitting for this film called Tigalopo or Mamu. And this is the Balfa Brothers. If you're just joining us, this is The Exchange, and my guest is Connie Castile, filmmaker Connie Castile, and this is on KRVS 88.7 FM or on the web at krvs.org. The station is a public service of the University of Louisiana Lafayette. And you can check out the website for a number of programs on there. It's also a nice, secure website if you'd like to help support the station and support all the different programs that we have going on here. And it's just a great site to get any kind of information about what's going on in the area and all the local national and international news. But as I said, my guest today is Connie Castile, and we're talking about the new film she has out, Tigalo, a Louisiana Horse Story. And we just heard a cut from the Balfa Brothers. And we did talk about there's a number of pieces of beautiful music that kind of threads its way throughout the
right.
whole entire film.
Now, that song isn't in the film,
yeah.
but it did influence the title.
Exactly.
And also, so Tigalo obviously comes from that song, but A Louisiana Horse Story is a nod to Robert Flaherty's Louisiana Story.
Ah, okay.
So that's kind of how that comes about.
Yeah.
But, and I might add, one of the reasons we're talking about this, I forgot to mention, we're having the premiere this Sunday.
All right.
So if, you know, I'd like to invite everybody to the ACA Sunday at 6 o'clock, and we'll get to watch it all together.
And you'll be there.
I will
People
be there.
Have a chance
Allison
to meet you.
Pretty much the whole crew will be there that worked on it, and hopefully we'll have a lot of people from the film there.
And what time is that at again?
It's at 6 o'clock. I know it's Mother's Day, but...
But that's a great treat for mom.
I think so.
That's right. Bring the family out.
Yeah.
You know? You're also going to be showing it, if people can't get there,
right,
on Sunday. It will be shown at Casa Azul in Gran Coteau on Tuesday the 15th, mm-hmm, at 7 p.m.
I think so.
Yeah, and then the following Saturday it will be shown at the Jean Lafitte Prairie Acadian Cultural Center in Eunice on Saturday the 19th on that afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you got three chances coming up to go see this film. Now, to go back, we're talking to what's great about what you've done with this film is that you have the French
right,
subtitles in this film also.
Right. It is an option on the disc, so you can, again, to reach out to our French connection there,
yeah,
French heritage.
Well, because it was interesting, there was one of the Creole gentlemen in the film talked,
mm-hmm,
about how he's so used to explaining or answering so many of the questions about in French that it took him, you know, a little bit to really have to think differently about,
yeah,
discussing it in English.
That was Randolph Joseph. He's with the Big Eight Trail Riders Association.
Yeah.
And he says in Creole, he,
yeah,
says, I speak better Creole than I do in English.
That's right.
And, but I wish I spoke French because I it could, I think, enhance these documentaries a lot, too.
But, you know, let's, because it's really broken down into different parts in this film, and you know, in the very early part of the film, you do take a look at the trail rides,
mm-hmm,
that go on with a lot of the Creole folks in the area,
mm-hmm,
and that is a thing too, where, you know, besides the information that's coming out of this film as a documentary, the filming is beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, and you watch the different angles that,
right,
she got.
Well, it's Alison Bull and Brian Richard.
Okay.
So both of them, I think they're the best cinematographers, I'll say at least the South.
Yeah,
so I'll
yeah,
go further than that, but they are just incredible. And, you know, they each shot, and I think you can't even tell. It's seamless. You know, you can't tell who shot what. Or,
yeah,
it's just beautiful, beautiful stuff.
Now, had you spent much time prior to this film at any of the trail rides before?
You know, it's difficult when you're dealing with these annual events because,
sure,
yeah, you do want to go out and do field work and kind of know what you want to,
yeah,
focus on. With the trail rides, I wasn't able to do that. I,
yeah,
did do that with the Le Tournois and Mardi Gras, which,
okay,
is they're both in the film. And even with the Selkie races, you know, we go to Andrew Cesaire's Triple C Ranch,
yeah,
and film his Selkie racing. The Selkie racing and the trail rides, I wasn't able to kind of do that before.
Yeah.
But,
You know, I'm going to tell you, it's interesting. You focus on the Prairie Laurent area,
mm-hmm,
which is in St.
Mm-hmm.
And I live where you focused, and I just live like probably two blocks from there.
Okay.
And so trail rides are a big part of our weekends, what we see. Now they come right by our house.
Right,
they've
right,
reopened a bridge, and it's always been a wonderful thing to see what a family, for a lot of folks, what a family affair.
Oh, I know.
That those trail rides
In fact,
are.
You say family affair. We almost named the film Family Affair.
Ah.
You can imagine you go through so many titles,
yeah, yeah,
ideas. But because everybody you talk to, even in the Mardi Gras, it's a family
That's
thing.
That's right.
Trail rides, it's a family thing. It's a family thing. Yeah.
And you know, the thing, too, is in the film, I like how you brought out some of the young people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the young people today. There was, and I'm not sure whose farm it was at, but you were interviewing.
Oh, that was Andrew Cesaire's farm.
Okay, and the young kids were, he was going to give the young kid a horse if his grades were good.
Oh, he did give him.
Yeah.
He was, like the kid says, he said, I was a bully in school. You know, he wasn't doing too well. His grandfather, Andrew Cesaire, gave him a horse. And he said, but I'm going to take that horse back if your grades don't pick up. And Andrew would check on him. And
yeah,
now he won, like, Student of the Year. And
yeah,
all these little kids, Andrew had given them a horse for 4-H or just to ride and all that. So it's interesting to kind of see how, okay, hopefully it looks like this is going to be a continuation. Somebody's
right,
going to be there to keep it going, which isn't always the case, as you notice in the film with the bush tracks. And you kind of wonder, well, where are the next generation of these high-profile, successful Cajun jockeys going to come from?
Now, the bush tracks, you know, for people who aren't familiar with what
mm-hmm,
those were, it was tended to be like an individual on their private property who first, like, started made the track, made their own, you know, as kind of their business?
Pretty much. You had a few here that are in the film, for example, Hébert's Clémence, which was in Abbeville. You had the Broussard track right out, right outside of the Acadiana Mall, right past the mall there. Those gates are still there. They're in the film. Timor Reese was another big track. And it did. It started out as somebody just putting these... It, all you needed were two tracks. Karen Crow Raceways was a big one, too.
Yeah.
Sometimes the lanes were separated by wooden planks.
Yeah.
If you notice in the film, too, we used some of Les Blank's footage from his movie Spend It All. And that's the one you saw, you were talking about the chicken, not the chicken, the cans.
The can, yeah.
So no jockey, just a horse with a little kid, and then this other horse with no human jockey, just these cans that rattle. They put rocks in the can to scare the other horse, and to scare the horse that it's attached to.
To keep riding.
Yeah, to keep riding. So there were some crazy things that went on, and that needs its own document.
That's right, yeah.
But... so that was so we do have Les Blank footage, for example, and we also have Philip Gould took a lot of photographs in the early 70s of bush tracks while they were still, you know, while they were still there, and we have his photographs as well in there that are striking.
And that's a kind of a reoccurring theme that keeps coming up with some of the jockeys throughout the film, you know, later that those bush tracks have gone out of business.
Right.
I mean, they've disappeared.
Yeah.
And what happens now to that tradition or that, you know, that form with our horse racers now when they don't have that to start out in, you know?
Because it was, they were special in that sense. So by the time these guys were old enough to get their license to ride at these recognized tracks like Evangeline Downs and all, they were seasoned riders because they had been riding since they were 5 or 6 years old.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And now, you know, you wonder, like, where are they starting out? Is it just, you know, people who, you know, grow up in a family that has, you know, horses and they ride, you know, where do they train when they're 8, 9, 10 years old, you know?
But I think, too, that that's an interesting thing about when you're dealing with folklore, period, is these traditions come and go sometimes, and or they just go. Look at even Mamou, that was had to be revived at some point. It was... There was the Mamou Mardi Gras. It stopped. Somebody brought it back. Tournois stopped for a little while. Why?
Sure.
Because the cowboys, the horsemen, were more interested in doing bush track stuff. And they didn't have enough interest in the Tournois.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So they stopped it, brought it back.
Can you explain, again, for people who don't know what the
Tournois
is? Yeah, because it's quite interesting.
It is interesting. Tournois is in Ville Platte. It happens in October. I can't remember if it's the second Saturday of October. And it's jousting,
yeah.
But they're jousting instead of another human being. They're jousting these 2-inch rings,
yeah,
with their lance, and they're going about 30 to 40 miles an hour on this little track. And there's 7 rings, and each ring represents an enemy of cotton. It happens during the cotton festival, so you have the boll weevil, silk, rayon, you know, all these different competition and threats. But It's fascinating to see.
And, you know, I know the artist, how I first found about it was Wavin Boone, who is an artist, has done, you know, for years, has done the poster. He did years ago for the Tournois. And he's got some great, like, some of the old posters, you know, that when they first were doing it.
And then just to show you how, like, at trail rides, people follow, the cowboys go to almost every trail ride they can get to. We go to film at the Mamou Mardi Gras. Well, guess who shows up at the Mardi Gras to participate? These people from the Tournois that we had just interviewed.
Yeah,
you know, it's like,
yeah.
Okay, so it's they just love horses.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing, too, when you look at tradition, you noticed in the film with the Tournois, it was very, when they were, you were showing the one gentleman getting ready, you know, for it, and how they were placing, it was kind of almost like a cape thing putting over his head. And
right.
That was a ritual in itself.
Same thing with Mardi Gras. Even just being a cowboy, there's, I want to say, not a costume, an outfit, but you prepare for it. It's a performance.
There's
You are preparing to perform.
Yeah. And, you know, so, all right, so this is going through from the trail rides. You've got the Tournois in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the whole bush track.
Mm-hmm.
And then into the racing. Did you run across any women or young gals?
I did not.
While filming, okay.
I did not. No.
And I always wondered about that with, you know, young gals wanting to race.
Right, right.
You know, wanting to do that.
Yeah, I didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, if somebody has,
yeah,
let the station know. I mean, I am curious.
I would love to know, too.
I'm curious about that, if there's, like, this underground thing of these young gals.
And TLO has a, we're on Facebook, so please, contact me that way, too.
Yeah.
I would love to hear it.
Or if there were some women, like, years ago who were, you know, off in some other field, you know, riding them, so, you know, learning
their own
how to
bush track.
Yeah, doing that. You talked about the sulky races.
Mm-hmm.
That was where they have, it's kind of like the buggy with the big tires.
It's buggy racing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just like bicycle tires in a sense. And that happens every other Saturday.
Because they still do those races, yeah.
It's going on right now at Andrew Cesare's Triple C Ranch and Metro Swallow.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can go and see that. In fact, we're showing the film June 9th over there.
Oh, wonderful.
It'll be Andrew's birthday, and that's what he wants to do. So,
is to show the film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, for there, it's, and that's any, or like, what age does that start out at? Do you know, like, in order to be a sulky racer?
Well, as the kids in the film say, we got to wait till we have the legs.
Ah,
you know, because
of
the way
you
sit in the buggy, your legs have to be long enough to reach the little, I don't know, stirrup, if you will. So, there's a size restriction. So
that you'd have to be in order
to
do that.
I think that's probably it.
Yeah. And then when you get to the actual, the horse racing, you know, the track racing. Now, that you filmed out at Evangeline Downs? Is that where you were?
We filmed a lot of the jockey interviews at the fairgrounds in New Orleans.
Then, oh, that's where you were at. Okay.
Well, no, then we go to Evangeline Downs, and so, you know, some of the horse footage, and in the jockey's room, that was at Evangeline Downs. They were very grateful to open it up to us and let us film. We filmed there about 3 times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's into some interesting interviews with Calvin Burrell.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And speaking of just the jockeys, like in the jocks room, not everybody gets access to a jocks room. So I think it's something that is interesting to see how that all takes place. I don't know if you remember a Disney movie, Casey Shadow.
Uh-huh.
That was basically loosely based, or maybe not so loosely, on Randy Romero and his father, who's a Hall of Fame jockey out of, I don't want to mess up, Abbeville? Is that possible? So that who Walter Matthau played,
sure,
Cajun Dad. So that was a big deal. And then you had Alan Lomax that was down here, and he covered Clemens in Abbeville, the bush track there. He's got some footage in that.
So I think there was a couple of the jockeys in the film talking about they had kind of tossed around the idea of wanting to open a place.
Open a jock school.
Yeah, the school.
Yeah,
that's
a
what
jockey
it was.
School, yeah. That's...
So there isn't anything in this that you know in the state?
I think there's one jockey school, and I'm not sure exactly. I guess it's in Kentucky, I'll just say.
Okay.
But they're thinking of giving back, the jockeys of Louisiana trying to give back, and again, getting these young riders access to riding before they get to Evangeline Downs. And since you kind of can't do bush tracks anymore, maybe, liability, a lot of bush track owners couldn't handle the liability insurance that they were having to start carrying, and so they just closed their doors. And maybe the jock school is the answer. I don't know.
You know, and because just like with so many other things in life, though, when you go from how those bush tracks were done, which is kind of a freewheeling.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like whatever goes kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
To a much more organized kind of school, you know, you wonder, okay, what effects is that going to have on how a jockey turns out?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know?
And as Calvin says, I mean, it was rough riding on the bush tracks. Anything went. There were no stewards. So, yes, there's some adjustment you probably have to make when you get to the recognized tracks. But if you're on a race and you need it, it's there
pull
out.
Yeah, yeah.
So that, I think that's why you have these Cajun jockeys that do well. They're very aggressive riders.
Oh, yeah. It's a tough... I mean, that's a tough business.
And, you know, it's not just Cajun, too. I mean, you had, that was one of the really cool things, I think, about the bush track. It was so integrated.
Yeah.
You had black jockeys. Marlon St. Julian's in the film. He was the first black jockey to ride the Kentucky Derby in 79 years.
Yeah.
pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
That was kind of brought out throughout a good part of the film, too, about how there was such this great mix of all the people,
yeah.
You know, and ethnicities, you know.
And the connection between the Cajuns and Creoles, you know, through food, music, and horses, lifestyle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. How long did this, you know, because I know you had some grants for it, so did you get it done in a year?
No, we had started it, well, again, because of the process, a lot of pre-production and all that. So you kind of can't go to your granting agency till you know you have a year's left worth of work to do. So we probably worked on that for 3 years.
Okay, all right.
And then when you're dealing with these annual events, too, you kind of hope you can film at least twice in case you get...
And you hope the weather cooperates.
Yeah. Well, you know, we were all ready. I was so excited to go to Joe Fontenot's Piney Woods Trail Ride last year to film, and a tropical storm came through.
That's right.
So we took our beer, our ice chest of beer, and went sit on the porch at... With Boudin from Johnson's Boucanier, and we went sit on the porch at St. Street Inn and played cards.
That's it instead, yeah.
We definitely have fun when we're making these things.
Yeah, that's right. Well, what? Do you have any projects that you're working on now?
Well, you know, funding is pretty bleak these days. The LEH grant was actually their last grant cycle
because
for documentaries.
They're not granting right now.
They shut down their programs, lack of funding from the state. Division of the Arts shut down their folk life program 2 years ago, maybe two or 3 years ago, because of state cuts. Louisiana Entertainment, which I you know, applaud them. They started a Louisiana Filmmaker Grant, but you can only apply once. So I got that this cycle for Tigalo. So I think what I want to do is set up a website, kind of move into the 21st century, where you know people can come and access the documentaries, and do a lot of field work. I have a lot of ideas, and maybe I'll use this time to do a lot of the pre-production. So maybe by the time I'm ready to start production, funding will be better. And because I have a lot of ideas. There's no shortage.
Oh, I bet you
content,
do. You know, when you just think, like I said, you know, you so focus on for what that is for a lot of people, just everyday things they do in life. You know,
right? Subtle things, hopefully. I mean, this Tigalo is pretty epic. I think it is. It covers a lot. There's a lot of information, but I don't think it's just some dry. You know, like education. I mean, it is educational, but I hope it balances it with you are receiving a lot of information, but I hope it's being delivered in a
it really
fun,
it, oh it really is because you're not overwhelmed you know, during it at all. How did you stop? You know, I mean, I think about that sometimes with filmmakers, and especially with documentary. You go out and you get so much footage, and you have so many, you write so many different things down, and so many different directions. How do you stop? How did you stop without wanting to keep tweaking and keep adding? And
yeah,
you know, I mean,
I still want to tweak and add.
I know you do, but you know, for other filmmakers starting out,
I think yeah.
How do you get yourself through that process?
Right. Well, you know, you got to set a time limit, and again, the grants kind of dictate that to you. So that kind of does it. And if there's really something that, you know, like I did have to get an extension, you know, from LEH just because it just wasn't ready. So I got a little extension from them. But no, I think you start out with these ideas, and that's great. But eventually, the content starts to tell you what it needs to be or what needs to be in it. And sometimes it's just a matter of, like, for example, Gino is in here briefly, though, but I had intended for him to be a bigger part in the film, but it was just about not getting together, like missing each other. Or, yeah, I can't do it here, I can do it there. And then before you know it, you got to wrap up. So there's those situations too in documentary, or people aren't accessible now, but yeah. So it's hard in a sense. I've never done a narrative, but people that have said documentaries are a lot harder because of that reason. A narrative, you have your production days, you have everything, it's shot, you know exactly, you know, bam. Documentaries, you're kind of at the mercy of the folks, and that's okay.
And now you talk about narrative. Now, you did have a narrator in there. It was Carl Brazel.
I mean, like fiction films, but...
But I'm just tying that back in. He has a great voice for things like this.
I know. He used
to
do...
A great voice.
He used to do radio, So, yeah, he's definitely got a radio voice. And he's just wonderful. And he loves the culture. And he speaks French. So I think, you know, none of my films have narration, just this one.
Yeah.
And the reason is I had felt like I had to have one is because of that historical context that we have to deliver.
That's right.
But it happens in the beginning of the film, but then you can't just lose your narrator, so I had to keep him in it throughout so that, you know, he just doesn't disappear. But usually I just like the people to kind of tell the story.
Sure. And now, at the showings, will people have an opportunity if they want to purchase a copy?
Oh, yes. They have many opportunities.
I want to remind people, because we are getting down to the end here, they have the premiere of Tigolo, A Louisiana Horse Story by filmmaker Connie Castile, is going to be this Sunday, which is Mother's Day. Great time to take the whole family, take Mom. It's going to be at the Acadiana Center for the Arts in downtown Lafayette, and that's at 6 p.m.?
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then it's going to be shown at Casa Azul in Grand Coteau on Tuesday the 15th at 7 p.m., and then we'll be at the Jean Lafitte Center, the Prairie Acadian Cultural Center in Eunice on Saturday the 19th. And
that's
if
it.
People go there, they can also pick up a copy. It's really, people really need to go see this film. It's so, on so many levels, it's informative. It's this great educational piece. It's so entertaining. It's funny. It makes you think. It's, I mean, it really captures all kinds of, and then the visual and that, the sounds and the music. I mean, those are such powerful pieces to this.
I mean, it's a celebration of the cowboy, black and white, Creole and Cajun. So,
and we want to find out what's going on with you women cowboys out there.
Yeah.
With you female cowboys. Connie, I want to thank you for coming on today.
Oh, thank you.
Appreciate it. This is another great piece that you did. You're doing so much to add to people's lives in this area.
Well, thank you, Cheryl.
Yeah.
Appreciate that.
We are going to go out listening to a cut from Gino Delafosse, and it's off his Everybody Dancing CD, and this is another Tigolo Pour. I don't have the full title here, but have a good week, everybody. Next week, we're going to have Chubby Carrier. Go out and see Tigolo, A Louisiana Horse Story. Have a good week, everyone.
Red and Rise, rider number 19, Jared Mott. Jared is riding his horse, Cat.
Tu vas tomber, tu passes là, mais ne vont pas du tout. Tigalou, mais pour la pointe au père.